The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939. This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
It was a short week on Wall Street, but it was also a strong one as equities rebounded from key support levels on Monday. Despite the growing concerns of rising COVID-19 positivity rates and select states pausing or rolling back their reopening phases, the U.S. stock market had a great week, up more than 4% with all 11 sectors advancing. Over the past month, the technology sector was the best performer, up about 7.5%, with discretionary stocks coming in second place, up slightly more than 3%. The worst performing sectors were energy, down more than 5% over the last month, and utilities, down slightly more than 3%. Technology stocks were helped by the continued preference for growth and large cap havens in the equities this week. In addition to positive earnings results that influenced the strength in technology stocks through Micron, who had positive earnings and guidance, as well as some positive revenue outlook from Xilinx on Tuesday. Another big news item this week was Boeing's announcement that the 737 MAX is on its way to getting approval to fly again. That sent it and the transports higher earlier in the week. We continue to get news about COVID-19 rising in early open states. As I mentioned, last Friday, I reported on Texas taking measures to curb growth by pausing its reopening plans and shutting down bars. California has taken a similar stance recently, and others have as well. These are being looked at as prudent courses of action that will likely help in flattening those exponential growth curves, has not affected too much the bullishness that is persisting right now in stocks. Economic data this week continued to assist the bulls in supporting the stocks. Let's start off with May's pending home sales, which blew away expectations, up 44.3% versus 18% growth in April. June consumer confidence was up to 98 from 92 previously, but that's still well off its February high of 132. June's manufacturing ISM moved into expansion territory at 52.6, versus May's contraction reading of 43.1. So a very big increase there, back in a positive territory. Friday, the jobs report helped lift futures and caused stocks to gap up higher at the open, with unemployment down to 11.1% for June and 4.8 million jobs being created versus a consensus for 3.5 million. While May's jobs number was revised higher to almost 7 million. Hourly earnings did fall, down by 1.2%, and weekly unemployment claims is still elevated, but has ticked down to 1.42 million. Finally, factory orders rebounded in May, up 8% following a 13.5% decline in April. So most of the economic data we're getting this week continues to show improvement and that reopening efforts are working to help the economic recovery. It's a short week for the market, and we thought we'd give our wonderful technicians the week off. So I'll jump in real quick with a summary of current technical setups for the financial market we're watching. We continue to see strength not only in mega cap tech stocks, propelling the NASDAQ composite to yet another all-time record this week, but we also see strength in commodities right now due to a weak dollar. So looking at West Texas oil continues to consolidate near $40 back from the dead, as they might say, near $10 back in April, not that long ago. So copper has been on a tear since bottoming near $2 a pound and is currently right around $2.73 a pound, last I checked. Spot prices for gold have recently broke out above a key level, which was $1,750, and we continue to hold a significant allocation for our clients there. So we continue to be pretty bullish right now on gold, and we think the breakout was a very good and nice move this week to help in that trend. We think that as long as gold is in this uptrend and treasury yields stay low, that gold could have a nice run here. Key supports that continue to hold the S&P 500 have held this week, and which has caused a bit of a rebound. And that was right around 2940 to 2980 as the support zone. For the NASDAQ, that's 9,500. and 133 on the Russell 2000. And because these key areas of support have held this week, we continue to feel that we're more in a sideways consolidation, given the previous uptrend in stocks that could be constructive towards a further uptrend here. So I continue to see constructive charts in the cyclical sectors of transportation, industrials, materials, and discretionary areas, despite some recent weakness in financials and energy. So because of that, we are continuing to feel a lot more bullish towards equities than bearish, given that we're not seeing the more defensive areas of the market having relative strength here versus the rest. So these cyclical areas are very constructive towards a bullish tilt in the stock market. And to call an end to the consolidation, I'd like to see the Dow Industrials and the Russell 2000 trade back above their respective 200-day moving averages. They were above them briefly in early June and have been trading back below that. So that was a bit of a whipsaw back then and has caused some, I think, more nervousness towards possible future weakness. But again, those key support levels that I mentioned earlier are holding, and that is encouraging. So overall, we think equities are in a consolidation mode that hasn't been decided yet which way it's going to resolve, yet I'm encouraged by the overall strength in cyclicals that point towards continued economic recovery. So a speed bump in the ongoing advance, I think as long as states don't have to take a more drastic measure to roll back reopening efforts, stocks should be fine as we continue to see economic numbers improve. We're currently at or below neutral allocation towards equities until evidence shows us that these exponential curves flatten more or a vaccine officially passes all trials. And remember, the earnings season is right around the corner. Great results again from Micron and Xilinx, but there's going to be quite a few more companies that have to pass over the same hurdle. We want to see better than expected results, both in earnings as well as projected guidance, if they can at all do that at this point. Remember last quarter's earnings results from the first quarter, many companies gave up giving guidance, obviously in a very uncertain environment. So a little return of certainty might add a little more confidence to stock investors. That's it for this week's quick update.
It is absolutely spot on to refer to this as an arms race. So without a doubt, the folks that are committing fraud are also increasingly going to be using artificial intelligence to do a whole bunch of things, Chris. One of those will be finding personal information about different kinds of people to build fake persons, fake identities that they can use to build up that will seem very legitimate, that they can, build a credit history for, that they can, eventually commit serious fraud with. And the same with cybersecurity, et cetera. So the adversaries are also going to be using tech, not just their brains. And undeniably, part of what's going to drive this tech forward is the fact that we're going to be steel sharpening steel. And it's without a doubt, if your fraud plans in the next 2 to 4 years, and you're a, let's say, enterprise level financial services firm, if your fraud plans in the next 2 to 4 years do not involve ML in any way, you're definitely off kilter. Now, there's a lot of areas of AI and finance that I would not say that about, but when it comes to fraud, it's very, very big. And a lot of our clients are heeding that advice, fortunately. Also, I think that there's a natural inclination to move towards risk, particularly in banking. We do a lot of work with big banks who want to reduce regulatory risk, and fraud and money laundering are obviously a big part of that. If ISIS is buying missiles through your bank, I mean, it's just not a good look.
If you want to listen to this full interview, in addition to our three other interviews that we air each week with some of the best book authors, industry experts, and leading investment strategists from around the globe, just go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Do you dream about throwing out the alarm clock so you can travel, enjoy your hobbies, or just relax? You've worked hard for decades and want to cash in on all that hard work. Now it's time to develop a plan that can help you get there. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today to get your retirement plan started. We can help to make sure you have the income you need to live the lifestyle you want, how to maximize government benefits from Social Security to Medicare, reduce taxes and plan for future inflation, or protect your assets with an estate plan. Don't leave your retirement up to chance. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com.
Well, Well, the price of energy is holding firm in the upper 30s and 40s, but how high will it go and what level of a price will it need to go for companies to start drilling again? Joining us on the program is Dan Steffens from Energy Prospectus. Dan, the BP Statistical Review, which is one of the Bibles for the energy industry, came out this week. And the surprising thing about it, as much as we think of a green world, renewables is about 5%. 84% of how this world runs is still run on fossil fuels. And Dan, I don't see that changing remarkably over the next 10 years. I mean, I just don't think everybody's going to be driving a Tesla electric car in the next 10 years, or the trucks that deliver goods to the stores are going to be electric.
Yeah, wind and solar is going to increase, but think of the entire demand for energy. That pie is just going to keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So as they increase, they may go from 5% to 6% over a couple of years, but to replace the incredible amount of energy that we get from hydrocarbons, it's never going to happen. You would have to fill half the country with windmills and solar panels, probably just to get rid of half of the gasoline we use. So it's a long way. And I think it's a misconception that people have that we can eventually get to a totally green economy. You just can't do it.
No, it's still going to be fossil fuels. And the other thing, too, is they're making gasoline engines much more efficient. There's right. better mileage in the composite materials they use in cars. But I want to talk about where we are now. We've seen the drilling rigs drop precipitously. I think they're, what are they down? 60, 70%. And let's talk about what that means in terms of balancing the market, because we went from about 5 million barrels a day in production to almost 13 million as a result of shale. So let's talk about what those drilling rigs mean for the shale industry right now in future American production.
Well, back in April, the predictions were that the U.S. active drilling rig count would drop to 400. And I think it's already dropped to like 260. And then there's also this misconception that with oil going back to $40, that a whole bunch of these rigs will go back to work. Well, that's not going to happen. These upstream companies that I follow, and I follow like 50 of them, they have trimmed their drilling and completion budgets, and they are not going to expand those budgets again. They can't immediately go back to the market and say, oh, we got a little bit more cash flow, so we're going to spend it all and drill more wells, and they'll get killed by the market. So you won't see a significant increase in the active drilling rig count until we get back to about $50 a barrel, and they're also very confident that it's going to stay for a while. And that probably only happens if we reduce the fear level of COVID-19.
And, you know, when we talk about that and you say that it gets back up to 50 where people are actually making a profit, and it, like you said, is going to have to remain at that level to be confident, because you're not going to start up and then it goes from 50 back down to 40 or back down to 30, because this is a lot of money that these companies have to put mm-hmm. out, and they don't want to be pushing oil out the door and they're losing money. Let's talk about some of the minor players in the number of companies, Dan, that are filing for bankruptcy. They just can't get financing. Banks aren't rolling over the loans. What is that doing to the shale patch? And what might that mean for production going forward?
Well, at $40 oil, or where we are now, most of these companies are generating positive cash flow from operations, but they can't really expand their drilling programs unless they have access to capital or they have a lot more cash flow. And there's very few drilling locations in the shale plays that are economic to drill new wells, so that you include the drilling and completion cost in that. So you take a well that was going to, at $50 oil, would pay out in like 2 years. Well, at $40 oil, now it takes like 4 years to pay out that well. And so the return on investment isn't fast enough. And, you know, so the banks are, you know, really trimming these credit lines for a lot of the small caps, and they're just kind of forced to live within cash flow. Now, they can live within cash flow for quite a while at $40 oil, because the operating expenses of these wells is typically well under $10 a barrel. So they're generating solid cash flow, but the wells cost $7, $8, $9 million to drill and complete. So You know, they're a long way from paying out at this price.
Let's talk about something we're also seeing happen as a result of these lower prices. Companies like British Petroleum just wrote off $17 billion of assets. Shell just wrote off $22 billion of assets. Let's talk about what that means for our listeners. As I understand it, Dan, these write-offs are because at these levels, you can't operate a well and make money, so the assets are written down. So correct me if that's right or wrong. And secondly, if you can't operate at this level and you write them down, what happens if the price turns around?
Well, these aren't just voluntary write-downs. They are required by SEC accounting and GAAP, generally accepted accounting principles. Upstream companies are required to write down their assets to market. And they're also, any assets that they're not going to develop in the next 5 years have to be written off. Now, for your listeners, that doesn't mean they're abandoning the property. It just means at, say, $40 oil, if oil remains at 40 for the next 5 years, they're not going to go out and drill this deep water prospect, you know, where they need at least 50 to break even. So they can't keep it on the books. So they write it off. Now, kind of the thing that bugs me about these accounting rules, if suddenly the price of oil rebounds to $60, it's announced that we have a vaccine that's going to work for COVID-19 and, you know, everything's hunky-dory again and everybody gets back to work. Oil would quickly go back into the 60s, I'm sure. And they cannot write those assets back again. Once they take the write down for any quarter, it's gone forever. So they can't write. Now, you know, that makes them more profitable in the future because those costs are going to run through the income statement eventually, either as depletion or depreciation, or they're just going to be written off all at once. So it makes them more profitable in the future. So it's just a timing difference. And that's why I tell people, focus on cash flow from operations. It's the most consistent thing in all the financial reports each quarter that really tell you what a company is going. Cash pays the bills, not GAAP accounting net income.
You know, one issue that I've talked to on energy experts on this program, and this really began in 2014 when the price of oil dropped with the Saudi price war. And from 2014 to 2016, a lot of projects got canceled. Companies start cutting back on expenditures. And it's happening again as a result of COVID and the price war this year. Dan, let's talk about the long-term implications because wells deplete. And especially shale wells, you've got to constantly be drilling. It's like running faster on a treadmill. So if you take a look at the last 6 years, we have been underinvesting in the sector. And some like myself, yourself, and even Marshall Atkins think that this is going to cause a problem. And I believe an oil shock in this decade because a lot of, whether it's offshore projects or even onshore projects, a lot of these have gone underinvested because companies simply haven't wanted to invest. And then the mantra that's coming from Wall Street over the last year or two, even when prices were higher, is investors said, I don't want you to go for growth. I want you to either pay down debt or return cash flow to investors in the form of dividends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a diff. You know, Wall Street's not going to suddenly just start pumping cash into these companies again. You know, it's going to take some time to heal the wounds. The other thing to remember is U.S. oil production just in the last 3 or 4 months has gone from 13 million barrels a day to 11 million barrels a day. So a 2 million barrel a day decline. Now, I would say about 500,000 of that is economic shut-ins, are shut-ins because storage was filling, and so maybe 500,000 of that will come back. But our depletion rate now, overall, if we would just stop drilling, if we would have stopped drilling on January 1st for whatever reason, just totally stopped drilling, our production would have declined about 28%. We have a 28% depletion rate now. And if you go back about 10 or 12 years before the shale boom, the depletion rate in the U.S. was 6 to 8%. Annual. So our annual depletion rate, which means we're on this treadmill that we have to keep drilling more and more wells just to hold production flat. And today we have less than 200 rigs are drilling for oil. We have about another 80 to 100 that are drilling for gas, but less than 200 are drilling for oil. We need at least 500 or 600 rigs drilling for oil just to hold production flat. And so And that's not going to happen. I don't care if oil went to 60 tomorrow. It would take 6 months to gear back up. So this lull, and it's not just in the U.S. If you look at Canada, Canada has almost entirely shut down. I looked last week, and I think they're down to 13 rigs running in the entire country, oil and gas. So they almost shut down the entire industry, and international rig counts dropping by 100 per month. This is going to, these birds are going to come home to roost, man. I'm telling you, and we have planted the seeds of an oil shortage that could be less than a year away.
That's, you know, I see the same thing. I wrote a piece called Oil Glut versus a Supply Shock. The thing that really strikes me, and this also relates to COVID, if you keep things shut down other than essential, and you know, what is essential is more political science than it is medical science, you know, stuff is going to start disappearing off the shelves. I mean, okay, you don't have to go to a bar. You don't have to go to a restaurant. A lot of those people, the government's going to put out of business, and hundreds of thousands of people are going to lose their job, if not millions. I don't know what it's like in your area, Dan, but you know, the restaurants are having a very tough time when you have to put tables outside in parking lots, or you're only allowed to operate at 25% capacity. You just simply can't make the numbers work. So what happens if we don't open up? I mean, we saw when this hit, there was a shortage of toilet paper. You couldn't get toilet paper. And some of these companies like Procter & Gamble went to 7 days a week production around the clock. And fortunately, that shortage was overcome. But what happens if you keep this thing shut down for another year? What happens to other industries? And what happens to what we see on the store shelves? I don't care if it's in a regular, you know, whether it's at Target or Costco.
Yeah, I've been preaching on my blog. We just cannot keep every time there's an uptick in cases shut down big parts of the economy again. I mean, we had a supply chain. Think of this as, you know, from oil coming out of the ground to going into storage, being refined, being delivered to your service station there. So there's always a bunch of product in the supply chain. And well, if you drain the middle part of that supply chain, or the starting point of that supply chain, let's say where oil comes out of the ground, significantly drops, and then suddenly you get the economy back going and consumption of transportation fuels gets back to where it was before, you're definitely going to have shortages, because there's now no raw material for that, and you just can't keep shutting it down. And I think we as Americans, and probably most of the people in Europe and whatever, we're so spoiled that the grocery stores always have the shelves filled. The gas station always has enough oil and gas for us. Well, that's not guaranteed, and you can't keep shutting down these vital supply chains for food, goods that we need every day to live on, and fuel. You just can't keep doing it and expect it all to keep working. It's going to fail if that happens. So anyway, we got to go back to work, and we got to produce the things we need.
And what about issues? I think this has been brought up during this COVID crisis, where we've outsourced much of our medical and our drugs to China. You know, I've got clients that have had difficulty getting medication because it comes from China. And what about relocating part of the supply chain? It just seems like that's going to have to be a national priority, because you can't allow 85% of your drugs and almost 90% of your vaccines to come from one country. It just doesn't work.
Yeah, I know. We've got to step back from this, and hopefully we've learned a lesson, and you know, bring a lot of this stuff back home. And you know, we need the jobs, so let's do it. You know, back on the supply chain stuff, one of our senior members wrote a long piece yesterday that he sent me, and he and his wife took like a 3-week trip, and they drove all over. And this guy was a former geologist or engineer or something, and they went through several oil fields, and he said he was literally just amazed that in Oklahoma, where there was, you know, 6 months ago, when you drove through central Oklahoma, you were always seeing a drilling rig. He said everything shut down, literally everything. There's no rigs running. And like most of Colorado's DJ Basin, totally shut down. Powder River Basin, he said, you only saw like one or two rigs running. It doesn't gear up overnight. And then once you fire the people, that's the other thing, the when the people are gone, getting them to come back, getting the equipment mobilized again, it takes a long time. So this, you can't, it's not just like flipping a switch and suddenly it all appears again.
So as you look at this, how much of what you think is happening now is more, I don't know, this is an election year, is political science versus medical science? Because a lot of this stuff doesn't make sense. You know, there for a while in California, you could walk on the beach, but you couldn't stand on the beach and you couldn't sit on the beach. I mean, and even in our city of San Diego, you couldn't sail in the bay. And I hate to tell the mayor, but sailors practice social distancing. It's called a marine collision.
Right.
I just wonder, after the election, if a lot of this changes dramatically.
Yeah, I definitely think that the Trump administration has painted themselves into a corner, you know, by coming out with this is, you know, first 2.2 million Americans are going to die. Then we know that that's not even close. And, you know, if we wouldn't have had New York and New Jersey sending sick people back to nursing homes, I think of our deaths, 60,000 of our deaths are from people in nursing homes after they sent infected patients back. So anyway, the point is, this has got to somehow get back to normal. And I just think they can't, you know, like, Trump cannot come out tomorrow and say, you know what, the recovery rate is now 99.5%. Now that we have done all this testing and we know that many more people had this and recovered on their own without ever being tested, now we know that. And we know that the death rate is about the same as it is for seasonal flu or less. So we need to get going. I don't think he can say that, because you know that the Democrats and the media is going to paint him as the big murderer that just, you know, if there's even an uptick in the number of deaths. And so I just think it's political science. I think we're so wrapped up in this now, it's like we can't reverse it until we come out with a cure, some kind of vaccine that's legit. But they have made tremendous progress on treating the disease, and that's why the death rate has come down so much.
So given this, and I think it gets better next year, we'll probably have a vaccine. I know several companies, from Pfizer to Johnson & Johnson, are hoping to have one. They're testing in the fall and have one on the market in the first quarter. I think Johnson & Johnson is planning on 1 million vaccines or even more than that. Given this, let's talk about the industry itself. I can't think of I had Marshall Atkins on my show last week. And he says, you know, this is one of those rare events in investor history when you take a sector that is so unloved, mm-hmm. underowned, and undervalued and hated. I can't think of any industry that's probably the black sheep of Wall Street than the energy industry, and prices have never been this cheap.
Yeah, several things make this an unbelievably good time for investors, I think. First of all, you need to find which companies are definitely going to survive 2020. And a lot of them are going to survive just because they got most of their oil hedged at $50 or more through the end of the year. So they got that. Because because oil under $50 is an unsustainable price, you will see you won't be able to find and produce the future supplies to meet demand at under $50. So we got to get above that. And I think the multiples, man, I've got my Sweet 16, which is high quality companies, and I've gone through their liquidity, their balance sheets, and they're going to survive this year. And it's trading for less than 3x cash flow as a group. There are individual companies trading for like 1x cash flow. And I'm talking about companies like Pioneer and EOG and Cimarex. These are high quality companies that have survived many oil price cycles and have a lot of their production hedged at good prices. They're in great shape. So there's where it is. And then also, you know, if the economy starts coming back, the midstream companies are trading at great discounts to their dividend yield. Our high yield income portfolio has like a 10% annual dividend yield. So there's a lot of good stuff out there, but you got to find the ones that definitely have, the bankers are backing them, or they don't have much debt and they can live within cash flow through the rest of this year. And if it comes back, there's huge upside. Because then if the multiples, let's say let's say instead of trading at the group trading at 3x cash flow, starts trading at 5x cash flow, 6x cash flow, which is the more historical normal, you got a lot of doubles on this list.
So, Dan, if our listeners would like to find out more about the work that you guys do, you follow the industry, you have a newsletter that comes out, and you track these companies, tell them how they could do so.
Yeah, we are a subscriber service, and we provide a monthly newsletter and then individual company profiles and forecast models on about 50 or 60 companies per quarter. If you'd like to get that information, our normal subscription fee is $350. But if they send an email to energyperspectus@gmail.com, Sabrina will give them a promo code so they can get $100 off their first year. And we'd love to have them as members. And our Sweet 16 since the end of April is up about 60%. It's rebounded, but there's a lot more upside in this sector for sure.
All right, Dan, if we were summarizing, even though prices are low right now, for this to be sustainable, it's got to be at $50 or more and sustained at that level for drilling to come back, or otherwise it's not coming back, mm-hmm. and which sets us up, in my opinion, for an oil shock.
Yeah. And don't forget natural gas, too. With all this lack of drilling and shut-ins and everything, we may be looking at a very tight natural gas market by the end of this year.
Unbelievable. Well, listen, Dan, as always, pleasure having you on the program. Stay safe and come back again.
No, you too. Thanks a lot.
I think it's time for us to declare the V-shaped recovery or the quick recovery to be dead. And maybe that's not a good metaphor to use in a case where so many people are dying, but that's what should happen to that forecast. It's going to be a long, slow, uneven recovery. It's going to vary not just by country to country, but within the U.S., as you said, it'll be different in every state. The only agreement that we have is that all of the forecasts, as I said earlier, are in a downward direction and keep being revised downward. We just don't have a good sense as to what the relationships are going to be in the future. There's also what the International Monetary Fund has been calling scarring, which is that long-term impacts on the economy in terms of companies that have been forced out of business, companies that have had to not just lay off people, but are not rehiring, as to what that's going to mean in the future. And we just don't have any idea of what the impact of that is going to be.
If you want to listen to this full interview, in addition to our three other interviews that we air each week with some of the best book authors, industry experts, and leading investment strategists from around the globe, just go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Are you tired of earning a minimal interest rate on your investments? Are you looking for a higher rate of return on your money? Financial Sense Wealth Management has put together a portfolio of high dividend paying blue chips, high quality interest paying bonds, and preferred stocks. Our income account portfolio is specifically designed to help meet the needs of retirees, pension funds, and foundations looking to increase income and reduce taxes. To learn more, contact us at 888-486-3939. Or email grow@financialsense.com.
Welcome, everyone, to this week's Big Picture. The title of today's show is The Long Road Ahead, a look at the decade ahead of us. And one of the key messages that we've been sharing week after week is how this is one of those seminal events, life-changing events, that is reshaping society and societal norms for years, if not decades, to come. And we're going to give you just a few statistics that really put this in perspective. If you think about the first half of this year, we went from just in 3 months from an unemployment rate at 3.5% all the way to 14.7%. That was within 3 months when COVID hit. During the depths of the downturn, just under 7 million unemployment claims were filed in a single week. We saw a 38% plunge in the markets, followed by a 43% rise. 103 bankruptcies were filed as of June 1st. Oil going from $40 at the start of the year down to negative $37 with the craziness that happened in the futures market. Fed's balance sheet is now at $7 trillion and it is growing $1 trillion a month at the current rate. And basically, the Fed has backstopped financial system and is now buying corporate bonds where they're concerned that we could see a fallout. So, Jim, how significant is it when you think about all of those stats that we cited just for the first half of this year?
You know, the amazing thing about some of those stats that you talked about, Chris, in the depths of the Great Depression, the unemployment rate got to like 24.9%. We went from 3.5% to almost 15% in 3 months, not 3 years. And if you take a look at even in the stock market, in a matter of weeks, we lost close to 40%. And in a couple months later, we're up 40%. You know, we've done a number of interviews on our Monday show, which is called COVID Special Report. And we have another a special report coming out on Monday where we interviewed a gentleman that's in charge of the hotel industry. And some of the facts that are coming out, just to give an example, folks, typically occupancy rates run between 75 and 80% during the summer. They're now at 46%. They need 55% to break even. According to our guest, nearly half of these hotels are not going to make it. In other words, they're not coming back. And we're going to get to the implications of that. But, you know, you and I were talking before we went on the air, Chris, and I was thinking the implications of this are so far reaching. They're going to change so much of what you've known is normal in your life over the next decade. I mean, this isn't going away in the fall. It's not going away at the end of the summer. It's not going to go away a couple of years from now. When we were interviewing the head of the hotel industry, they're anticipating that it may take them to 2022 to get back to pre-COVID levels. And that's assuming at the end of the summer, in October, when business travel takes over from summer vacation travel, that business travel comes back. If it doesn't, this is going to get much, much worse, which is why some experts are saying that there is another wave of white-collar unemployment ahead of us if we don't turn this around. And I don't think our politicians have any clue as to the damage that some of their policies are doing to this economy.
Well, as Ryan talked about at the beginning of today's show in the wrap-up, you know, we did see a very positive private payroll report that was for the month of June. And then also we saw an upward revision for May. That was the ADP number. So 2.4 million jobs were added in June. And a lot of that was led by small businesses. So that's a positive report. And obviously we got to give some credit to the economy showing some resilience here. One of the problems though is, again, that's last month. And now at this point, as of right now, when you and I are speaking, over 40% of the population, that's the U.S., has now seen reopening halted or reversed. So it's a question to see how much that's going to impact some of that positive trend that we saw for last month, if that's going to get now short-circuited by the fact that 60%, we're only about 60% open at this point. So a lot of interesting things that we're tracking, obviously, week by week as this story unfolds.
Yeah, and one of the reasons we saw the big jumps of employment, Chris, was the whole purpose of PPP was, as the government shut down businesses, to keep your employees on payroll so that when you did reopen, you could bring those people back. And that's what I think you saw in the months of May and parts of June. This surge that we've seen was a lot of those companies reopening again. But now, like here in our own state of California, the governor just shut down bars and restaurants again. Gatherings are, I forget what the number is now. Gatherings of more than 25 are prohibited. They haven't shut down the San Diego beaches. I think they've shut down the beaches in L.A. So we're seeing every state from Arizona to Texas, parts of Florida, and now California going back in the shutdown mode.
So again, Jim, when we're talking about just how life-changing these events are, how much they're going to be reshaping society for many, many years to come, if not decades, I mean, going through the economic statistics, just how far-reaching they are in terms of hotel industry, travel, leisure, the number of people that have lost jobs that are slowly coming back, thankfully. But, you know, on top of this, there's a lot of people that are just going to be out of work for quite a while.
And the government is trying to support them. We have, you know, a lot of policies that have been put in place for a safety net, unemployment insurance that is there. That is good. But on the same flip side, when people don't have work or they've been let go from a job, they're not going to be happy. And we see, I think, you know, history books are going to look back at this period and see the riots, the protests. This is part of just a massive change in society that is part of what we're going through with COVID, people being cooped up for months and months, not able to go about their life, their normal routines. So these are all part of an environment that is unfortunately contributing to business, financial, and economic uncertainty.
Oh, absolutely. I have a sister-in-law that works for a major department store that was furloughed for a couple months. And then as we began reopening, she went back to work, but then they had riots and looting, and they had to close down the shopping center because of damage, and it just wasn't safe for employees. And we see this every night on the news. I don't care if you're looking at what's going on in New York City, Chicago, Seattle, Los Angeles. New York just defunded the police department by $1 billion. Los Angeles is thinking of doing the same. Minneapolis is thinking of getting rid of the police. And, I mean, you just take a look at what we've seen probably over the last 6 weeks. I mean, tens of billions of dollars of businesses have been looted, burnt down, or destroyed. And it's not just that. There's something else going beyond it because we're seeing history being removed. We're seeing statues taken down or destroyed, names changes, calls for a totalitarian Marxist state to replace the Constitution and free markets. And so it's not just civil disobedience with people that are just saying, you know what, I got a small business, I'm sorry, but I've got to open up to survive. But it's also a number of unhappy people that don't like the system or the country that want to change it. And we're seeing all of this convulse together. And we'll talk about later on. There's a book out on this by George Friedman called The Storm Before the Calm, and talks about a very unsettling decade of social turmoil, which is we're starting to see right now.
Yeah, and I think you and I would agree that if you were to poll the overwhelming majority of Americans in this country, when they see a statue of the first American president coming down, or a number of the other founding fathers, that is something that is distressing, right? I mean, you're talking about the first president, essentially a symbol of the foundation of America. And we're coming up on 4th of July here pretty soon to celebrate Independence Day. So at the very same time that we're moving into the 4th to celebrate American independence, we have founding fathers, statues of founding fathers being taken down in the name of systemic racism, in the name of, you know, anything or anyone who had participated in slavery. So it appears that we're undergoing a societal revolution of sorts.
Yeah, I mean, it's just absolutely amazing in terms of back-to-back events that have followed basically since the middle of February. Like I said, if you were to go back to January 1st this year, markets at record levels, record unemployment, everything is just going great. The global economy is recovering, and just a complete reversal of fortune in just a matter of months. And the thing that, Chris, I think we need to put into perspective is, okay, I think the number of deaths now is up to about 125,000. There is a little bit of suspect on those numbers because there's a lot of pressure for doctors and hospitals to label deaths as COVID because the hospital gets reimbursed. I mean, you get somebody that comes in, doesn't have any insurance, you have to treat them. And if they die, they don't have any insurance, the hospital doesn't get reimbursed, put COVID on the label, and they do get reimbursed. But to put this in perspective, and this is from the latest mortality tables. Now, this is as of 2017. Heart disease deaths per year, and I'm rounding these numbers off, 650,000. Cancer, 600,000. Accidents, unintentional injuries, 170,000. Respiratory diseases, 160. Stroke, 150. Alzheimer's, 120. Diabetes, about 90. Influenza and pneumonia, about 60,000. Intentional self-harm, suicide, 50,000. And so you're talking about shutting down almost entire economy other than essentials for what is turning out to be a very severe epidemic, something we haven't seen in 100 years. And so at what point does the cure outweigh the disease? And I think that's what we're getting into, because you're shutting down so many businesses, literally hundreds of thousands of businesses are being destroyed, hundreds of businesses every single week. These are jobs and businesses that aren't coming back. And we've talked to several experts in the field. We have an interview coming up with the head of the Hotel and Restaurant Association talking about what's going on in the hotel industry right now. Things are pretty dire. They're only at about 46% occupancy level in the middle of summer vacation season when they're normally at 80, and they need 55% to break even. And they're talking about, they're real worried if we don't see business travel come back in October, because as vacations end, normally business travel and conventions pick up the slack following the summer vacation period. So you're talking about, and some of the rules that some of these governors are coming up with, Chris, are more political science than it is medical science. And even when it comes to medical science, the healthcare directives have been so inconsistent, and they're constantly changing. First, we weren't supposed to wear masks. Then you were supposed to only wear them if you had COVID. Then all of a sudden, everybody's supposed to wear masks, to now they're even questioning the efficacy of these masks. The problem is, Chris, a lot of these politicians, well, they get a paycheck. They get benefits. They're medical. They're not disturbed. They're not out of work. And they have no idea what they're doing, and many of their decisions are doing to the economy. And that's why you've seen, in addition to a lot of the civil unrest, you've also seen a lot of civil disobedience from a salon owner to a gym owner that are basically saying, hey, I've got to feed my family. I've got to open up, and I'm taking steps to make sure my customers or patients are safe. But these are going to have long-lasting effects, Chris. And as we have talked to many of these experts, there's simply a lot of these businesses, probably half of the hotels and restaurants in this country are going to go under. I would say probably half of the retail centers in this country, and this was long before COVID, they're going to go under. A lot of these stores, Chris, why don't you share with our listeners your story to the malls recently, where you went to a major mall that both of you and I live close by. And I'm talking about a major mall with big anchor tenants. Share some of that experience. I haven't gone to a major mall yet, so I can't talk about that, but share that.
Yeah, I had to go pick up an item, and it just so happens that the only store that was nearby was at the mall. So, you know, I went on a Saturday. It was right around noon, peak mall time, right? Normally, you would go pre-COVID, and it would be slammed. It would be hard to find a parking spot. Inside, it would be a rush of people. But, you know, obviously, in our post-COVID world, the parking lots were completely empty. About half of the stores were closed and the lights were out. So it was kind of felt a little bit like a ghost town. There was some people wandering around. The Apple store was actually decently busy, although they did restrict the number of people that could go inside the store and you had to set up a reservation. But that said, there was a few people mulling around outside the Apple store waiting to get in. But other than that, it was basically deserted. And you think about it, if I were just to guesstimate about 50% capacity of, you know, number of stores actually open, I mean, that's half of all those stores. And there's a lot of stores there. I mean, we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of stores that are not operating. So that's loss of revenue. Obviously, you know, what are they going to do? They're going to have to rely on the government for loans to get them through this period. So yeah, it was a very eye-opening reality when, on again, a peak day on a Saturday when you would expect it just to be slammed. And that was obviously not the case at all.
Yeah, because I'm very aware of that shopping center. You're lucky on a Saturday if you can find a parking spot driving around the parking lot for about 15 minutes. But, you know, once again, the economic impact of everything that you're seeing here, it's disruptive to business, and it's also going to change business. It's going to change, for example, how we shop. We're going to be shopping more online, a trend that was probably in place prior to COVID. It's going to change how we spend money because times are more uncertain. That's why the savings rate in this country is over 13%. It's going to change the way you enjoy leisure or travel. And the other thing that's going to come along with it is government response is going to be massive, both at the fiscal level and at the monetary level. At, you know, beginning of the year, the Fed's balance sheet was slightly less than $4 trillion. It's over $7 trillion, growing at $1 trillion a month. The government passed $3 trillion of stimulus, and they're about ready to pass another stimulus bill that it's rumored to be close to $3 trillion. So the government deficit this year could be $5 trillion or more. It's going to change a bunch of things societal-wise and as well as the business and the economy. I mean, life, what used to be normal, is going to look much, much different. Chris, if we were to be, let's say, going to the year 2030, looking back at the 2020 decade.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting how Chip Rogers, which you'll hear on Monday, how he's talking about how over 60%, I think it was 64, 65% of hotel spending is actually business related. And so what they're hoping is that they're going to see an increase in, I believe he called it bleisure, right? So that's business and leisure travel combined, where you have, instead of a couple employees going to stay at a hotel, you have an employee and their family combining the business trip and the leisure trip together because they're working remotely, perhaps out of the hotel room, since it doesn't matter if they don't have to be at the office. I thought that was an interesting remark. I don't know if that's going to take off and how much that's going to help the hotel industry, but that if we're working from home and we don't have to go in the office, I tell you, it wouldn't be a bad idea, or it certainly would be nice to think, yeah, I could be on my laptop next to the pool or in my hotel room rather than cooped up in my home office.
Yeah, and that's exactly what they're talking about, because typically from around the end of May all the way to September is the vacation period. That's when hotels are at maximum occupancy, which is normally around 80%. They're at 46% now. And then as that ends, as you go back to school, October picks up. That's business travel. Then you have conferences. Think of the Consumer Electronics Show in Vegas. That's going to be interesting if that's going to go on in January. I heard it is. And then what they're hoping is people will say, well, you know what? There's a good reason for me to go someplace, I don't know, New York, Washington, D.C. on business. But, you know, maybe, or Florida, maybe I can get some business done from the hotel room while the kids are enjoying the poolside or, let's say, a theme park or something. So they're hoping that comes back. But it's definitely, Chris, a lot of what we're seeing today is going to be changing. I don't care if it's sports, to concerts, to restaurants, to leisure, to travel, to shopping. All of that is going to be changing dramatically in the next 10 years.
So, Jim, let's tie this back into, you know, some of the things that we're seeing as far as what how the government is responding, especially when we think about small businesses and some of the other important economic impacts.
Well, the one thing that we've been talking on this show and I've been writing about in my End of Money series, I just wrote a piece, The Transition from Paper to Things, and that is the blueprint for inflation, and that is modern monetary theory. It's embraced by Wall Street. Wall Street loves it because it inflates assets. Politicians of both parties love it because they can spend money and just give the voters whatever they demand. And then academia loves it because it supports progressive socialism. So the blueprint for that is a new book out. It's called The Deficit Myth, Modern Monetary Theory and the Birth of the People's Economy. It's written by Stephanie Kelton. She's a professor at Stony Brook. She was the chief economist on the U.S. Senate Budget Committee for the Democrats. She was also a consultant to the Bernie Sanders campaign. She has written a book saying that basically the government is different than you and I. In other words, they don't have to operate, balance the books like you and I can. They simply can print money when it's denominated in their own currency. The only drawback to government printing money is inflation. But it goes along with the redistribution scheme that John Maynard Keynes talked about in his book on unemployment in the 30s. and he talked about the rentier class. This was, he had a disdain for the upper class in England and talked about the rentier class, those that lived off interest, dividends, and assets. And one way to redistribute wealth is through inflation schemes. And so you're talking about a loss of value through inflation. And, you know, I'll give an example. You've heard we've been in a disinflationary trend. And if you have the chance, read my latest article on the site. It's called, it's part of my End of Money series, From Paper to Things. And I give an example of what you could earn on money by decade. So, for example, in the 80s, you could earn $140,000 a year in safe investments. I remember when I first got in the business, I was doing Ginnie Mae's. They were paying 14. Heck, I was getting 15% in treasuries. And by the time you got to the 90s, it dropped down to 80,000. Then it dropped down to 70,000. Last decade, it dropped down to 40,000. Now, when you get to this decade, on a $1 million right now, if you were to go into 10-year treasuries, you would make less than $7,000 a year. So your money is buying you less and less goods and services. And that's the direction. If you want to read Kelton's book, I highly recommend it. And Chris, that's something that the markets aren't anticipating right now. Investors aren't anticipating. And it goes to a theme that I learned in the business, that you only really need to make a few key investment decisions in your lifetime. And that is, find a trend that is emerging, get aboard that trend, and ride it until that trend completes itself. Think of commodities in the last decade. Think of tech stocks in the 90s, Japanese stocks in the 80s, commodities in the 70s. And so this is one of those pivot points in history where the investment markets are changing and they're going to change. And we've got basically the government scheme and the theory behind what we're going to see unfold in this decade.
So, Jim, the question that we always ask on our show, as a money management company that helps clients with managing their money, of course, is how do you do that in an age of turmoil and turbulence like we see today?
I think the era of indexing and passive investing is dead, Chris. Active management is back. And, you know, one of the things that we saw in the downturn in February, which was fast and furious, the 60-40 rule didn't help you. You lost money in bonds. You lost money in stocks. About the only place you made money was cash and gold. Very similar to what we saw happen in the fall of 2008 during the financial crisis. About the only thing that made money was cash. And actually, gold didn't make money because gold went down during that period of time, not as much as other assets. So we're transitioning, in my opinion, which is my latest article, we're transitioning from an era of paper, think of 2010 to 2020, when paper assets made money. I don't care if it was stocks, bonds, whatever it was. Stocks went up, bonds went up, and all that made money. Now we're going to transition to where hard assets are going to be the way to preserve their money. It's going to be foreign currencies. One of the ways we sidestepped the tech bubble is we had 40% of our portfolio in European sovereign debt and the debt of Canada and Australia. It's hard to believe, you know, given the negative interest rates in Europe. But back in the year 2000, you could get 4 or 5%. I remember getting 3% on sovereign Swiss bonds, 4 to 5% on German and French bonds, Canadian bonds, and Australian bonds. And so, you know, you're going to have to do that because the dollar is going to be depreciating. So we're going to be in this era where things that maintain value are going to be things, assets, commodities, real estate, gold, precious metals, stocks. And when I wrote my first article, The End of Money, I showed what happened in countries that devalued their currency. And I had a graph of the currency with the stock market. I showed it for Argentina. I could probably show you that for Mexico. I could show you that for Russia, Turkey, and other countries. So, you know, you're going to have to think much differently in terms of asset preservation and earning a return in the next decade.
So, Jim, it sounds like what you're saying is investors are going to need to be a little bit more flexible. I mean, again, as we noted in the beginning of the show, we saw a 38% plunge followed by a 43% rise. That is unheard of volatility that we have not seen for quite some time. These are some of the types of events that lend towards being flexible and having to shift into other asset classes or parts of the market, it sounds like.
Yeah, and I'm going to recommend two books. And by the way, you've interviewed both authors. One is George Friedman in his new book, The Storm Before the Calm. If you want to get a bigger macro sense of what's coming ahead of you. And another one is by Peter Zion. He's written a book called Disunited Nations. He's talking about the global order that was in place after World War II coming to an end. That was when the U.S., with its military, basically supplied safety for world trade. And now we're starting to withdraw from that. We are asking other countries to take that responsibility. Zion talks about that. And also this kind of attempt to go to clean energy, as Zion talks about in the book and the University of Finland talks about in their comprehensive study, it doesn't work everywhere. It works best, believe it or not, in the United States because of our geography and resources. But it's not going to be a clean, easy transition. It's going to take longer than expected. And he talks about the coming turmoil in international affairs. So both Friedman and Zion, I highly recommend their books, all three of Zion's books and George Friedman's latest book. I think you'll find it very enlightening. And it'll give you a bit of a perspective as you look forward into the future.
So, Jim, given these changes, again, which we've been discussing are a very large scale in nature, we are living in momentous times, I think, to say the least. What are some of the practical things that we're doing at our firm for clients?
Well, one of the things we have done, and this is just our philosophy, we've operated in the global bond markets for decades now. You know, we operate with sovereign bonds, corporate bonds. And we like that because it gives us flexibility. We can control the outcome. We control the income. For example, when we saw massive dollar depreciation, we were in foreign sovereign bonds. So we not only had a good interest rate, but we also got the appreciation of the currency as the dollar was debased. So that's something that we do. The other thing we did because of we're at zero interest rates is we developed an income fund, which is roughly about 60% in high dividend paying blue chip monopolies or oligopolies. These are high dividend stocks that have yields that are two or three times what you could get in government bonds. And then we have preferred stocks. We also have it hedged with gold and gold dividend paying stocks. So we're investing in areas like energy. We're investing in technology. We're investing in healthcare. We're investing in precious metals. So it's more of a fund that's designed to produce increasing income, but also tax efficiency because dividends are taxed at lower tax rates from 0 to 20% versus tax rates that can run as high as 37 to 40. And then finally, as a result of dealing with corporations have the same problem. What do you do if you have to keep large cash balances in your business to run them? If you're a money market fund, you're getting zero. A lot of these money market funds have dangerous debt that they're holding on that may be illiquid, may not be able to back up the buck. So we have a corporate management account. If you're a large corporation, you need to manage cash. So we're doing that. So that way we can have provide a business safety, but also at least somewhat of a return on their cash. And then finally, you know, we're more tactical and active asset managers, which allows us to either raise or lower our risk levels depending on what we see in the economy or the markets. And it's one of the reasons we were able to sidestep a lot of the damage that took place in the months of February and March. So, Chris, you know, you have to adapt. What worked for 10 years is not going to work in the next 10 years. And let me give you an example, a recent example. If you were in a S&P 500 index fund in the year 2000, the markets lost over 45% in the next 2 years. It took another 5 years to get back up to where the markets were by 2007, but then the markets lost nearly 60%. So for almost 10 years, it took 13 years to get back to even If you were in an index fund in the year 2000, it wasn't until 2013 that you broke even. So you can go through large periods of time. 2000 to 2013 was one of them. 1966 to 1982 was another period where we went through a similar return. And so, and also what happened in the 30s. So these cycles come and go, but you have to adapt. And unfortunately, most people play, it's static investing. It's kind of like a pie chart. You put 60% in stocks, 40% in a bunch of bond funds. You just set and forget. Well, this is not going to be a set and forget decade. So it, you're going to have to be more flexible, and you're going to have to be you're going to have to think a little differently than the way we're used to thinking. And the best example I can give you is what happened in the last decade. If you were in stocks and bonds, you didn't do that well. You did that well in from 2009 to 2020, but you did not do that well from 2000 to 2013. So it's going to be a different decade, Chris, and you're going to have to dodge, weave, and be more alert because the investment environment is going to change. And the modern monetary theory is telling you how it's going to change. The government's basically telling you they got a blueprint for inflation and they're going to implement it. And the surprising thing about it, everybody's behind it. The Republicans are behind it. The Democrats are behind it. The bureaucracy's behind it. Wall Street is behind it. And the academics are behind it. So it's being put in place as we speak.
I'm really excited for an interview that we have for FS Insider next week with Russell Napier because, as I mentioned in the past, he is a noted deflationist. He's been talking about this disinflationary trend that we've been in for probably about a decade or more. He's now changing the tune, saying that, as you just said, that the players are now committed to bringing about inflation. And so he's made a U-turn in his thinking based on what we see that's taking place with modern monetary theory and elsewhere. And he's calling for inflation ahead. Well, Jim, with that said, since we obviously provide these services and these are the things that we are doing here at Financial Sense Wealth Management, what would be the best way for our listeners to give you a call and discuss how we may assist them?
Well, they can call us toll-free, 888-486-3939, and either ask for myself or one of our advisors, and we'd be glad to talk to you. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Sheridan and myself, you guys have a safe 4th of July weekend.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.